Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Protests continue to rage nationwide as tens of thousands of people descend on airports to rally against Donald Trump's executive order, establishing a moratorium on entrance into the United States by citizens of seven majority Muslim countries. But Trump is sticking by his deeply unpopular order despite global outrage. Donald Trump spoke with King Salman of Saudi Arabia and pledged his support for so-called safe zones in Yemen and in Syria. Donald Trump had criticized Hillary Clinton's interventionist positions on the Middle East during the campaign, but now it appears he is getting ready to implement, well, at least a part of her program. Donald Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin for the first time over the weekend in a phone call lasting nearly an hour. Is a thaw in U.S. relations between the U.S. and Russia in the making? What are the big issues? But first, we turn to Donald Trump's executive order and the nationwide and global protests against it. We are joined by Raed Gerard, Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome back, Raed.
Thanks for having me again.
Thank you. Here's what Donald Trump said on the campaign trail in 2015. Quote, Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. So, Raed, by signing the executive order, is Donald Trump following through on his campaign promise?
Definitely. There is obviously an attempt to disguise the Muslim ban under national security. But there are a couple of very clear evidences as of now that this is indeed the Muslim ban. The first evidence is the exception to non-Muslims in the executive order itself and in the White House's announcements that followed. So the ban is exclusively to Muslims from these countries, and non-Muslims will be allowed. The other evidence is what we heard on Fox News yesterday, when there were discussions about how Trump reached out to Giuliani and asked him to head a committee to implement the Muslim ban in a legal way. And Giuliani himself said that he went through these discussions with legal experts to make this Muslim ban work legally. So it's not a secret anymore. I think it's official now that this is the first step of the Muslim ban, and I'm sure that we will see additional steps coming up in the next few days and weeks.
People in the United States, all over the United States, are occupying airports. They're obviously gathering together in public spaces. They gathered on Sunday and, you know, by the thousands or perhaps tens of thousands, they surrounded the White House. During the last few days, you can see that America is completely polarized on this question. Do you think this is going to backfire on Trump?
Well, he's obviously overplaying his hand, and it is a good test case for him to see whether it's going to go through or not. It's also a good test case for all those in the U.S. who are opposing the Trump agenda, to see if they can stop him at this stage. I think failing to stop these executive orders will give a signal to the Trump administration that they can do whatever they want. So now they are feeling the public resistance. They are feeling the resistance from other government institutions, from the judiciary branch, from the legislative branch. And this whole thing might be a test balloon. It might be only the first step, but either way, it's a test for both sides, the Trump administration and for those who will be opposing this Trump agenda for the next few years.
Yeah. ABC News reported that there were 735 encounters at U.S. ports. These are their words, ports of entry under the executive order. Nearly 394 of the people caught up by enforcement of the order were legal permanent residents, and all but two of them entered the country. By Sunday evening, Homeland Security said nobody was being held anymore at airports. In your opinion, would this have happened if it wasn't for the intervention of these tens of thousands of protesters at JFK, at LAX, at San Francisco, SFO, at BWI? I mean, all over the country. It's been a phenomenal few days.
Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that the public outcry has created real pushback, and the Trump administration is pulling back a little bit. They're trying to give new interpretations of the executive order, trying to play it down. But definitely what happened at airports, or even what happened with federal judges issuing a stay on the order, or what we've been hearing from congressional leaders, all of these things are extremely effective tools and mechanisms for curbing this administration with its agenda. So I have no doubt that the current developments are linked to all of this pushback.
Let's look at what Trump's executive order actually does. It restricts for 90 days entry into the U.S. for people from seven predominantly Muslim countries: Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Now, why these seven countries? Saudi Arabia, of course, according to the U.S. government's report of what actually happened on September 11th, 15 of the 19 hijackers who crashed planes into the buildings at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon were from Saudi Arabia. Has anybody from any of those countries, why those countries? Talk about that.
I'll make two points. The first point is that these countries were selected by the Obama administration. And what the Trump administration is trying to do is to normalize their racism and their radical policies by building on some of President Obama's own policies. So they're referencing policies that happened in previous administrations as precedents to what they're doing now, because they know that they're shooting for something unprecedented. So they're trying to normalize it and make it seem as if it has happened many times in the past. So the seven countries were actually selected by the Obama administration as countries like hotbeds of so-called terrorism, and the Trump administration is building the first step of the ban on that, so that when someone asks them why, they will say, well, this is what the seven countries that the former administration chose. How come you haven't had the same level of cry out and freaking out during the Obama administration? So I think it's a tactic. It has more to do with politics and attempting to disguise what's going on now. The second point, I have heard this question a few times in the last few days. To tell you the truth, I'm not a big fan of this argument. The argument of trying to question why these countries are on the ban and not other countries. Because I'm against the ban completely. I don't think we have to have a list of countries. It's not a question of which countries end up on the ban and which countries do not end up on the ban. It's really a question of whether we will have this ban or not. So unfortunately, I've seen like even a few of my friends and allies who have been mentioning or repeating these questions about Saudi Arabia or Saudi Arabia citizens, or trying to insinuate that Saudi Arabian citizens are behind 9/11 attacks, or they deserve to be on a list or not. I refuse these arguments, not to defend Saudi Arabia or Emirates, but to reject the Islamophobic blanket statements trying to blame Muslims of a certain country or of all countries for the acts of violence of a few. So I'm against adding any country, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Emirates, whether its citizens were involved in previous acts of violence, or whether it was Iran or, other countries now. I don't think it's a good idea to get into the weeds of which countries are included at this stage, because that might, in a way, open the door up for the Trump administration to say, okay, we hear what you're saying. Let's add up Saudi Arabia and Emirates and Lebanon to the list. And now what? Are we going to say, no, now we change our mind? So that's my point. I think a better way to oppose is, rather than show the you know, that this administration is hypocritical is to say this is a ban that we refuse. We refuse to have any countries on this land, whether it included our friends and allies, whether it included people who we liked, we didn't like. We're against the ban at all.
Very good. I agree with you. I want to ask you how this is going to play out in terms of U.S. foreign policy. The Iraqi parliament, in a non-binding resolution, supported the banning, sort of a reciprocal ban on U.S. citizens coming to Iraq. It doesn't have the force of law right now. There's also, of course, discussion in Iran. It would seem to me that there would be discussion in all of the targeted countries that there would be some sort of reciprocity. But besides reciprocity, how do you think this will play out in terms of U.S. foreign policy implications in the Middle East?
In a way, I think it will reaffirm what many know already, that the U.S. government, as an institution, that there is institutional racism, there is institutional Islamophobia, anti-Muslim sentiment. And these things existed all along. They were sugar-coated under some administrations. And I think under this administration, there is no sugar there. So it's adding more clarity to this discrimination and anti-Muslim sentiment that this administration is having. So that will definitely expose the U.S. government's real feelings and the way that they actually view Muslims and allies in the Muslim world. But at the same time, of course, it will cause a lot of suffering, you know. I was just watching CNN last night. They had an interview with an Iranian grandmother, 75-year-old grandma, who was held at Los Angeles for 9 hours. And she has a green card, and she's been coming to this country since the 1990s or something. So, of course, it will cause so much suffering to families of Muslim Americans and Muslims who are trying to come to the U.S. for visits or for work or for study. It has real implications, you know, like in real life implications will affect the lives of millions of Muslims around these countries and around the world. It will also create a chilling effect that would make other people not want to come to this country. Imagine if refugees are being turned back, they won't be choosing the United States to come to moving forward. And this is also one of the intended effects of what the Trump administration is doing. One of the intended effects is to create this chilling effect, is to create a scary reputation about the U.S. to deter refugees and immigrants from coming in the first place. That they would love to have that situation where people would stop coming rather than being turned back from here.
Raed, I want to ask you, I know you're a political analyst and commentator and advocate, but as an Iraqi American, someone who was in Iraq and who came after here, I believe after the war, when you just think back about all the devastation caused by the United States, all the terrorism imposed on Iraq by the United States, the bombing of your country for more than 25 years now, and the continued bombing of Iraq today under new rationales, and then you have the American president or the previous president. Because, as you said, it was Obama who put these seven countries on the list. In other words, American presidents who have bombed Iraq over and over and over again, identifying to the American people that the threat of terrorism comes from Iraq. I mean, how does it feel?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues that I have been speaking about for a decade now. How refugees and the refugee crisis is portrayed here in D.C., as if the United States is engaged in an act of charity. We're so nice that we're getting, you know, these poor people to come to this country. And sometimes it's portrayed as us being too nice for getting too many people to this country. But unfortunately, the angle that I usually talk about, which you touched on now, is not covered, which is the United States has a moral and legal responsibility towards many of these refugees. You know, the seven countries that President Trump just banned its citizens to come to the U.S. Are all countries with a history of U.S. military intervention. Some of them go as back as the U.S. intervention back in the 50s and 60s in Iran and supporting coups and supporting war and militarism in the 80s against Iran. Or some of them are as recent as now, you know, the U.S. bombardment of Libya and Iraq and Syria and Yemen. So the U.S. has been a destabilizing factor in all these seven countries. And the fact that this president is blaming those countries for being places of instability is really ironic, because there is no historic context there to the United States' responsibility in creating that mess. So from my perspective, accepting refugees in the U.S., especially from these seven countries, is not an act of charity. This is a small contribution to the United States fulfilling its own responsibility for destroying these countries, for making these countries inhabitable for their own people. So when we talk about these issues of refugees and immigrants, sometimes they are taken out of context, and the fact that the violence that has led these people to leave their countries in the first place is linked to the U.S. policies is usually missing from the discussion.
Yeah, in just 30 seconds, right, Donald Trump also says, we should have kept the oil, maybe we'll have another chance. In the last 30 seconds, how do you react?
Well, the U.S. never had Iraq's oil. Iraq's oil is for Iraqis, and the U.S. never had it, the U.S. will never have control of it.
Okay, that's Raed Girard. He is the Government Relations Manager at the American Friends Service Committee. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump spoke with King Salman of Saudi Arabia and pledged his support for the so-called safe zones in Syria and in Yemen. Trump criticized Hillary Clinton's interventionist position on the Middle East during the campaign, but now it appears he is getting ready to implement some parts of her program. We are joined by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for joining. The readout of Sunday's phone call between Donald Trump and King Salman of Saudi Arabia stated, quote, the president requested and the king agreed to support safe zones in Syria and Yemen, as well as supporting other ideas to help the many refugees who are displaced by the ongoing conflicts. Help the audience understand, what is a safe zone? What do they mean by safe zones? Is it about helping refugees? Is it about a greater or different kind of intervention into Syria? Go ahead.
Well, it's not about helping refugees. That we can say for sure. As to what it actually amounts to, we're not really sure. We'll have to wait until the details come out. Trump has apparently referred the whole problem to the Pentagon, and they asked them for a report on how best to implement that. But I presume some kind of safe zone implies a no-fly zone, which implies taking protective measures against Syrian or Russian Air Force, you know, incursions, which is very dangerous, very dangerous.
Indeed, it would seem to fly in the face of what Donald Trump has said repeatedly and in the face of many critics about who are criticizing him as either Putin's Manchurian candidate or a puppet of Putin or somebody who doesn't understand the Russian menace or whatever. But of course, that would put him directly at odds with Russia's policy, which has been to support the existing unitary Syrian government now led by Bashar al-Assad. Whatever happens to Assad in the long term, and we can talk about that in a transition, certainly, it would seem to me that any Syrian sovereign government would oppose the U.S. creating safe zones within its territory without its permission. And that would put Trump at loggerheads, it would seem, with the Russian government.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first of all, I can't imagine that Syria will give its permission or that Yemen will. Of course, there's no government in Yemen, though, of course. But, you know, I really wish that Trump was Putin's puppet, at least in this regard, because then he might make some sense. But the guy is just—I mean, he's crazy and he's an idiot. He has no idea what he's doing. He criticized Clinton for her interventionist policies, and now he's doing the same thing. It's completely mad. He says he wants to fight ISIS, but of course, teaming up with Saudi Arabia means teaming up with a prime funder of ISIS and Al Qaeda. So he doesn't know. He doesn't even know who's on first base.
Right. So, in other words, you're laying this at the doorstep of foolishness or somebody who really doesn't know what they're doing, rather than some grand plan by Trump or Trump plus his advisors to sort of alter the landscape inside of Syria.
I think it's the former. I think the guy just has no idea what he's doing. Look, and I mean, he's filled his cabinet and his key advisory posts with real Iran haters. Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, is somebody who just hates and fears Iran. So does Mad Dog Mattis, his Secretary of Defense. But the problem is, of course, is that Iran is a chief opponent, a leading opponent of ISIS and Al Qaeda, whereas Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf Sunni states are prime sponsors of those groups. So Trump doesn't know which side he's on. He doesn't even know that there's a side. The guy's, I mean, this is really just unbelievable. The world has a huge problem on its hands, and that is a ignorant, know-nothing maniac who is now occupying the White House.
But even though the president could have the defects that you mentioned, there is the existing sort of state apparatus. I mean, there are institutions of power, and the United States has been the dominant world power since the end of World War II, in other words, for more than 70 years. So there's real institutional setup with what had been a consensus or a near consensus on many foreign policy goals and objectives and patterns of behavior. So even if Trump is quote mad, as you are suggesting, or foolish, or doesn't know what he's doing, the people around him have some ideas about what they think the United States should be doing, no?
Yes, I presume so. But Trump is not an easily controlled guy. I mean, he's a classic bull in a china shop, and he's not gonna be easily tamed. But the important thing also is that these institutions you're talking about, these policy centers, they have collapsed. I mean, they got themselves in such deep trouble in the Middle East. They painted themselves into a corner, which is why Trump was able to – one reason he was able to do as well as he did against Clinton, because she was the architect, the leading architect of that disaster. So, so there's nobody able to stand up to Trump because there's just the field's been leveled. So he's the guy in control, and he has not the slightest idea of what he's doing. It's amazing.
That would be such a huge departure – I mean, for the United States. Again, we're talking about the post-World War II order. I mean, this was an order that was carefully crafted by the United States. They say in the years between 1943 and 45, when they were crafting what would the post-World War look like, they were establishing conceptually the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, U.S.-led or U.S.-dominated multilateral institutions – whereby the United States could put an end to the scourge of sort of inter-imperialist war and at the same time allow the U.S. to be the dominant power. In other words, everyone else would be the junior partner. What you're suggesting, Daniel Lazare, is that these centers of power have, in essence, collapsed or imploded as a consequence of U.S. overreach in the Middle East, allowing Trump, a destabilizing factor or figure politically, to take the realm, to take the helm. Then what happens to the CIA? What happens to the Pentagon? What happens to the military-industrial complex? What happens to the State Department with this deep bench of professionals? I mean, are you actually saying that all of that has come undone?
Yeah, it really has. I mean, look at the U.S., the post-war U.S. structure, which you described so well. It had a great run. It lasted for 70 plus years. But all good things come to an end. And this structure, which had been grossly overextended by the end and very poorly managed and got itself into real serious trouble in the Middle East, has essentially collapsed. And out of the ruins has emerged this rough beast called Donald Trump. And Trump clearly has no idea what he's doing, and he's going to he's just contradicting himself all over the place. And I guess what people are hoping is that cooler heads will take him in hand, and I guess that means Theresa May, Angela Merkel, and perhaps Vladimir Putin as well. I mean, somebody's got to explain to him who is on which side in the Middle East. Iran is not on the side of ISIS. It's a very simple question, but he doesn't seem to understand it.
The White House said about this was the readout about the call between Donald Trump and King Salman of Saudi Arabia, that they both talked about Iran, quote, Iran's destabilizing regional activities. Here you have Trump working with the Saudi king to sort of curb destabilization in the Middle East, creating, quote, safe zones in Syria. Well, of course, the Saudis, as almost anyone who's paying attention knows, were the main financiers, the main arms supplier for ISIS, for al-Qaeda, for the terrorist organizations that fragment and fractured Syria, which still control a big part of Syria. So what's the Saudis' game here? What are they looking for then?
Well, what the Saudis are looking for is quite clear. They want a U.S. protector. I'm sure the Saudis are going to be footing the bill for these safe zones, and they want the U.S. to protect them. And so they are overjoyed that they seem to have Trump in their camp. That's what they want. The Saudis are the prime source of destabilization in the Middle East. They've been funding, according to no less a source than Hillary Clinton, they've been funding Sunni terrorism for 30 years, ever since the war in Afghanistan. I mean, they are the great destabilizing element. Somehow Trump believes that somehow he can use this force to stabilize the Middle East. Now, that's crazy, but of course everybody in Washington has been saying the same thing for the last dozen years. But that's why U.S. policy is in such disarray. But now Trump is going to deepen the disarray by getting involved even more. I mean, it's really just mind-boggling.
When they talked about safe zones, and they talked about it not only in Syria, which is what we've already covered, they also talk about safe zones in Yemen. Of course, the Saudis are bombing Yemen. They've been bombing them for the last couple of years. The United States is paying for the bombs that are being dropped on the people in Yemen. The U.S. military, the Pentagon, is coordinating with Saudi military and Saudi intelligence for where those bombs should be dropped. What is a safe zone in Yemen? What do the Saudis mean about that?
I don't really know. I presume it's a formula that means for some kind of direct Saudi takeover, perhaps with U.S. backing, of Yemeni territory. That's what it sounds to me like. But, you know, no one really quite knows. I don't think Donald Trump even has a glimmer of an idea. But that's what it sounds like. It sounds like an incursion. It sounds like an escalation of that war. And that war, by the way, is just insane. It is one of America's worst crimes in the Middle East, and that's saying a great deal, has been to support Saudi Arabia in its attack on Yemen, which has caused 10,000 deaths so far, has left much of the country in ruins, brought it to the brink of starvation. This is a real crime, and Trump looks like, unless someone can somehow talk sense to the guy, it looks like he will deepen that crime.
Yeah. How do the Saudis see Yemen? I mean, is it a proxy war? Do they see the Houthis as the arm of Iran, their arch rival regionally, coming in at the Saudi border? In other words, creating a pro-Iranian government should the Houthis win or take over substantial parts of it? It's a war of aggression, but is it motivated by defensive considerations, or do the Saudis want something else?
It's motivated by paranoia. The Saudis are deeply paranoid about the so-called Shiite threat. They see the Iran as the center of the Shiite conspiracy, which extends from Lebanon and Syria to Bahrain, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia's own eastern province, which is where its Shiite minority is located, and also most of its oil wealth. So the Saudis are deeply paranoid about Iranian activities, and they therefore attribute the Houthi uprising to Iranian machinations. But it's not true.
Trump also spoke with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. According to the White House, Trump, quote, raised the idea of supporting safe zones for refugees displaced by the conflict in the region, and the Crown Prince, too, agreed to support this initiative. Tell us about the role of the UAE in the turmoil in the Middle East, and what's the significance of Trump's outreach to the UAE?
Well, the UAE is involved in the Yemen war, and there are some differences between the UAE and the Saudis, but in general, they coordinate policy, and broadly speaking, are in the same camp. And broadly speaking, also both want the U.S. to play the role of protector of the Persian Gulf Sunni states against Iran, against the so-called Shiite threat.
We're speaking with author Daniel Lazar about the call between Donald Trump and the Saudi king and other leaders in the Middle East, where they all agree that there should be safe zones in Syria or in Yemen, whatever that means. Another piece that was reported in Reuters, Daniel, about the call was, and I'm going to quote from Reuters, U.S. officials and people close to Trump's transition team have said a debate is underway in the Trump administration whether the United States should also declare the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization and subject it to U.S. sanctions. And apparently in the call with the Saudis, that was raised as well. That would be quite a gift for the Saudis, no?
Well, I'm not so sure, actually. The Saudis are ambivalent about the Muslim Brotherhood. They oppose them inside the kingdom, but they support them in Yemen. And these relationships between these various Sunni groups is complex and shifting. But declaring the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist movement would essentially create problems with Turkey, because Erdogan essentially is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. So that complicates things there.
Again, the approach it has so many contradictory features to it that, well, maybe that's what it is. It's just a ball of contradictions. In other words, as you're suggesting, perhaps nobody's really running the ship, or the person running the ship really doesn't quite fully understand where the ship's going or what its mission might be.
And he's driving at 90 miles an hour, too, to shift metaphors.
Yes. Yes. Let's shift metaphors. No, but it is dynamic. It's kind of breathtaking in a way.
Oh, yeah.
And when you put it together also with the decision to not allow people from seven countries, predominantly Muslim countries, to come in and to fulfill a campaign pledge to, quote, ban Muslims. That's what he said during the campaign. The whole thing seems to be like meant for additional destabilization. In other words, Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall. Donald Trump, can he put it back together?
No, he's intent on smashing him into ever smaller pieces. It's the whole thing. Listen, the mind reels. The U.S. has gone from the frying pan to the fire. As bad as Clinton was, Trump is at this point is shaping up to be even worse.
And there is a continuity, though, because of the interventionist orientation of Obama and Clinton, and of course George W. Bush. They couldn't stop themselves from going in place after place after place in the Middle East, disrupting, fragmenting those countries. But as Daniel Lazar is telling us, maybe also fragmenting the U.S. empire and its ability to continue to rule the world. That's all the time we have. We've been speaking with Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin for the first time since he's been president over the weekend in a phone call lasting nearly an hour. Is there a thaw in relations between the U.S. and Russia in the making? What are the big issues? We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Brian, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining us. Saturday's phone call between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin was one of five calls the new president had that day. It was said to last an hour. What can we make of the calls and the issues that were discussed?
Okay, well, a lot of this is reading tea leaves at this point. Both presidencies, both the White House and the Kremlin, put out a readout of the discussion that they had. The U.S. version was considerably shorter. It was a very bare paragraph than the Russian version, which went into create a great deal more detail into what the specific issues that they discussed. But it's clear even before the phone calls that there was an air of hopeful and positive relations coming from both sides. That is both the White House and the Kremlin are interested in restoring relations from what had been very probably a post-Cold War low point between U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Putin.
Mark, let's talk about how we got to the low point, because Donald Trump is signaling that he wants better relations. It seems to me that the Kremlin is also obviously signaling better relations, because as I think they said, how could it be worse than it had been at the last years of the Obama administration? But when Obama came into office, there's that photo of Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, with a great big red button standing next to Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and they called it the reset button. They were both smiling. They were both hopeful, it seemed, that there would be a reset, meaning an improvement in relations. What caused the relations to go from a reset to an even worse state than they were when Obama came into office?
Well, for starters, you could say very poor research on the U.S. State Department side, because actually the big red button that Clinton presented to her Russian colleagues, Lavrov, who greeted it with no little confusion, in Russian actually didn't say reset, it said overload.
That's funny.
Big overload button together, something that was of at least a little bit of embarrassment to Clinton's White House. But I think this has to be kept in context. Remember, if you remember that George W. Bush also came into office wanting good relations with Russia, meeting with Putin even, and saying that he could see Putin's soul, and basically that he was a good person.
He looked into his eyes and saw his soul, and he liked him.
Something that has since been retreated in the West anyway, with a great deal of mockery. So this is a repeat refrain, and this has kept Russian expectations for Trump-Putin somewhat low. They've played a game of lowering expectations and have very realistic and very pragmatic assessments, because we've seen this repeatedly where U.S. presidents come in saying rhetorically that they want better relations, but inevitably the two countries' national interests conflict and things start to go south. However, there are some more positive indications with Trump, and that he wants to completely realign U.S. foreign policy, possibly from what it has been over recent years. I think where Obama's White House went south very quickly, first of all, there was the Libya affair, when the U.S. turned a resolution that it told Russia and China that it simply wanted to begin humanitarian operations to protect civilians in Libya. And they very quickly turned that into a regime change bombing campaign, which resulted in the death of Gaddafi and the failed state warlord terrorist-controlled Libya that we see today with no coherent government. And this happened when Dmitry Medvedev was president for 4 years, while President Putin was prime minister. And Putin very definitively at the time voiced his objection to Medvedev agreeing to this UN Security Council resolution by the United States. Well, not agreeing, but not vetoing it.
Abstaining. Yeah.
China also abstained from it. And, this was then used as an excuse and as a green light, a go-ahead signal for regime change. Putin was not very happy with that, and I think there's a lot of discussion in Russia that's when President Putin had decided whatever U.S. president from the right or from the liberals that came to power in the U.S., that the U.S. would remain the same and that the regime change would continue. But then this was, of course, exacerbated by the open U.S. support for the putsch that seized power in Ukraine in 2014 and then began a war to conquer the rest of the country, in particular the Donbass. Russia intervened in the Crimea, and reunification with Crimea took place following a referendum. And then, of course, the conflict in Syria, where the U.S. has, you know, not even very covertly been waging a proxy war with the explicit goal of driving the Syrian president and his government out of the country, where Russia has come down on the side of the Syrian government, which they have had a longstanding mutual defense agreement. So Syria and Ukraine, I would think, are the two flashpoints, but you can see echoes of it even further back to Libya. And that brought things up to the fore right before the election. And the U.S. Democratic Party and some within the U.S. intelligence community accusing Russia of intervening or influencing or hacking their elections, which resulted in Trump becoming president.
Right. So step by step, incrementally, not necessarily a grand design to take relations south, perhaps whatever. I mean, it could be just short-sighted thinking, hubris, arrogance, normal imperialist sort of calculations.
Yeah, I think that you're right there with normal imperialist calculations. It's just that the U.S. hasn't, at least as of Barack Obama, hadn't given up on interfering in other countries and this interference driving ever closer to Russia's own borders and to their own national security red lines, of which, of course, Ukraine, you know, has for centuries been one of those.
One thing I'd like to talk to you about, Mark, is the realignment of Trump's foreign policy, perhaps, which, of course, it's a perhaps because it's just starting. There's many countervailing pressures. And who actually even knows what's going on in Donald Trump's brain? Because we don't know. And you've just taken yourself out of the Trump, I know Trump's brain group. So I'm with you there. But the thing that I wanted to talk to you about is Trump has lashed out against China. He said he no longer considers the one China policy to be, which was the bedrock of U.S.-China's bilateral relations since 1979 and even before. He said that's no longer, you know, he's not necessarily considering that to be inviolable. Russia and China are important partners with each other. There's the 2014 announced strategic partnership between Russia and China. Russia and China have both reiterated the primacy of that strategic partnership, which was upgraded since the 2012 strategic partnership announcement. If there's some thinking that what Trump and his team are actually doing is not simply trying to normalize relations with Russia, but have a bigger game plan, which is to separate Russia and China from each other. In other words, to play them off of each other, because in addition to their own...
A reverse Kissinger,
except this time Kissinger is also functioning as a Trump advisor.
Yes, yes. And evidently Trump and Kissinger have had a great deal of conversations with each other.
Yes, and we know that Donald Trump is impressionable. Like he said, he decided he wasn't for torture after James Mattis told him it didn't work, and because James Mattis was a general and his nickname was Mad Dog, that really impressed Trump. I mean, who knows what the level of thinking is going on here, but what's your view about that? Is it possible that the United States actually has that plan, and is it possible that that plan could work?
Yeah, this is a kind of a long-running thread in some of the last few remaining realists in the U.S. foreign policy greater, not in the government, but in the greater foreign policy establishment and academia, that it would be far better for the United States to ally with Russia against China. The thinking here is that Russia is no longer a world superpower. Its geopolitical horizons are much reduced compared to what they were when it was the Soviet Union, but that Russia has recovered enough that they can still play the role geopolitically of a spoiler or a kingmaker between the United States and China, which do have greater economic and geopolitical horizons. So there is the idea that the U.S. should ally with Russia, split it off from China, and also it should be said to split off Russia from Iran, because that's another side of this, because we know that the Trump administration has a number of individuals who are particularly hostile towards Iran, Michael Flynn, Mattis, and others among those. I have to say that several years ago, I believe the Kremlin could very well have fallen for this, because the Kremlin has long wanted good relations with the West. They want to be treated as an equal, as a partner, and they've long wanted to be part of a greater West, a greater Europe. The Kremlin, still many in the Kremlin, view Russia as part of Europe, part of a concert of Europe. They simply wanted their national security interests to be, you know, granted a degree of respect, at least to the point of compromise and discussion on those terms. They never got it. So particularly in the last 8 years of Obama, the Kremlin has been growing closer and closer, particularly to China, but also in recent years with the Syria crisis, much closer to Iran. And this has caused some geopolitical heads in the U.S. to turn, because they do realize that Sino-Russian, Chinese-Russian condominium is perhaps the one great geopolitical threat that could reunite Eurasia again, if you want to go back to the Mackinder School of Geopolitics, this Eurasian heartland, and present a threat to U.S. And the United Kingdom's Western-led hegemony as maritime powers. So this has been a long-running thread. I don't believe that the Kremlin is going to play ball quite like that. They might be willing to lead Trump on in that regard, if that is indeed his intention. But they know very well that Trump is likely gone in 4 years, if not before that, and that the U.S. foreign policy establishment is still completely hostile to Russia, the U.S. In fact, Trump will have a great deal of problem getting things through his own Congress with Lindsey Graham and John McCain, the neocons, already promising to cement anti-Russian sanctions and legislation so that Trump can't change them or improve relations, and indeed with his own cabinet, with many members expressing skepticism about the extent to which relations with Russia can be restored without compromising key U.S. global interests. But there is possibly another reading into this attempt with China, and then that a lot of this is bluster. That the U.S. has very little leverage over China, the two countries being mutually economically interdependent. China needs the United States for jobs to employ their economy, and the U.S. needs China for cheap goods and to borrow money from to sustain its own, you know, profligate spending on military and other matters. I just think the U.S. has very little leverage, particularly over the South China Sea. There's very little militarily the U.S. can do other than drive by Chinese islands and express Chinese-controlled islands in the South China Sea off of China's coast on the other side of the world and you know, do a parade around the waters, but very little else they can do. They can't really blockade these islands. That's militarily unfeasible. And anything else they would do would launch a full-scale conventional war with China, which would probably very quickly go nuclear. So the U.S. has very little leverage. And by trying to draw back one China, I think that Trump may be trying to dig back a little leverage in relations. Trump, what he may really want is not a geopolitical divide. He thinks like a businessman. And this reading has it that Trump simply wants China to stop devaluing its own currency to reduce the U.S.-Chinese trade deficit, allowing U.S. to sell more to China. And this may be one way, albeit a very dramatic way, of trying to get leverage back in China with relations and show that the U.S. means business. So that may be a completely different reading rather than a geopolitical reading of this U.S.-China furor that Trump has started.
Okay, that's Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst from Moscow. We're talking to him from Moscow. Mark, we have less than 2 minutes. Real quick, if Trump is orienting towards Putin in terms of a realignment of U.S.-Russian relations, the reset again, if he's also reaching out to Theresa May, which obviously is and emphasizing the special relationship, where does that leave these kind of relationships impacting on the U.S. traditional post-World War II relationship, say, with Germany, which, of course, is the dominant power within the EU? Now we have just a little less than 1 minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, very poorly. I predicted as a result of Brexit, the United Kingdom would grow much closer and start trade relations with the U.S., and indeed with Trump promising just that, and Theresa May, to the dismay of her own press and many within her own government, has basically been kissing Donald Trump's butt rather than criticizing him. Meanwhile, the leaders of Germany and France have been effectively lecturing Donald Trump, not only over the phone, but also in public, and it's no secret that almost all of the leaders of the EU effectively endorsed and ran against Trump during his own election, and don't think that Trump has forgotten that. I expect that U.S. continental EU relations to worsen severely over the next 4 years, and at the very least, that will limit the U.S.'s ability to project power abroad without having the EU as an ally, even if Trump decides to reverse himself and decides that regime change and invasions aren't such a bad thing after all.
We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Mark Sloboda from Moscow. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Well, that's all the time we have. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.